A very good afternoon to you, Namibia, and to all listeners tuning in from around the world. Thank you for choosing Eagle FM. I'm your host, Ndafa Happy Juju, and you are listening to On The Reading News Analysis, your trusted space for informed updates, critical insights, and unpacked developments shaping Namibia's economic, social, and governance landscape. Now, of course, it's Thursday, the 30th of October, 2025, and just a day closer to ending the month of October. And before you know it, we're stepping into November. Now, right here on the Radar is your weekday guide to what matters most. Bring you the headlines behind the headlines every Monday to Friday from 1300 hours to 1430. Now, this isn't just another news show. On the Radar News Analysis is about depth and dialogue. It is where we interrogate the stories shaping our nation, ask the hard questions, revisit past coverage, and connect the dots through archived audio, expert commentary, and sharp analysis. From major policy decisions to the everyday realities of Namibians, we bring you the full story with context, clarity, and credibility. Now, our interviews are long form for a purpose and in-depth because some stories deserve more than just a few minutes on air. So we therefore come prepared with research, background, and your questions to make sure every conversation brings us closer to understanding what truly lies beneath the surface. So remember, you can catch On The Radar live on all Eagle FM frequencies or Eagle FM via the Eagle FM app or the Eagle FM website. And don't forget to subscribe to our WhatsApp channel for real-time updates, exclusive interview clips, and behind-the-scenes content. So stay tuned, stay curious, and step beyond the surface, pardon me. This is On The Reading News Analysis, where Namibia comes to think. Now let's jump straight into today's top stories. The Namibian government has reaffirmed its commitment to improving the quality of life for all citizens through stronger collaboration between the public and private sectors. This was the focus of the Quality, Health, Housing, Land and Sanitation Public-Private Forum held on the 23rd of October 2025, which brought together key ministries, industry leaders and development partners. Now, at the heart of the discussions lies one central goal, that is building healthier, safer, and more dignified communities by ensuring every Namibian has access to proper housing, serviced land, quality healthcare, and adequate sanitation. The forum highlighted that thus four areas, health, housing, land, and sanitation, are deeply interconnected. Stable housing and serviced land contribute to community health, while access to clean sanitation and medical care supports a productive, dignified society. The government plans include delivering 50,000 affordable homes by 2029, formalizing and servicing 50% of informal settlements to ensure security of tenure and decent living standards, constructing 20,000 sanitation units in rural and peri-urban areas, upgrading hospitals and expanding e-health systems to improve access to healthcare, especially in rural communities. Now, these initiatives align with Vision 2030, NDP6, and the Sustainable and Inclusive Manufacturing and Industrial Policy of 2025 to 2030, all of which are designed to promote inclusive growth and sustainable livelihoods. Now, the private sector is expected to play a major role by mobilizing capital, technology, and expertise. Industry commitments include supporting workforce training and scholarships for healthcare professionals, partnering in the rollout of digital health systems, accelerating construction and land servicing projects through private financing, localizing supply chains to ensure Namibian contractors and workers do benefit directly from the development. The goal is not just to build infrastructure, so it says, but to create jobs, transfer skills, and build resilient communities. Despite the progress, several challenges remain in the health sector. Limited coordination between ministries, training institutions, and private partners continues to slow progress, delays in implementing the national e-health system, and low digital literacy among healthcare workers have also hindered efficiency. So in the housing and land sectors, the high cost of land and bulk infrastructure, outdated planning laws and lack of financial incentives have made affordable housing difficult to deliver. Many residents in informal settlements still lack secure tenure, making it impossible to access home loans or invest in property improvement. There is some recommendations and quick wins that have been pointed out, and in order to be able to overcome these barriers, the forum proposed several recommendations, one of which establishing national task force on health and housing that include private sector representation, launching digital pilot sites in health facilities to fast track e-health transformation, reducing health size from 300 meters per square meters to 150 per square meter to allow for higher density, lower cost housing, reducing residents by investment visa program to attract foreign investors while creating local jobs, of which I have recently had the President Tumwanandi Ndaitwah say that, I read it somewhere, that foreign investors who are certain or a relationship has been established that they will be investing in Namibia will be eligible to a 5-year visa free. Also unlocking pension fund investments and national infrastructure funds to finance land servicing. The forum concluded that with clear incentives, faster processes and shared accountability, Namibia can turn those national goals into visible progress in new homes, better hospitals, functional sanitation and meaningful employment across all regions. Now for the public context, for the ordinary Namibians, those forums mean better access to housing as fewer people living, that is reducing fewer people living in informal settlements, improved health services, faster hospital services through digital systems and trained professionals, of which perhaps we will need to get somebody to explain what digital systems in terms of health actually mean, what do they entail and what possibilities are they. Also more jobs through construction, healthcare and infrastructure projects, cleaner environments through expanded sanitation projects, especially in rural and peri-urban areas. So now the success of these initiatives will depend on a strong collaboration, of course, between the government, the private companies and the citizens themselves, ensuring development is inclusive and community driven. Now for now, before I do bring in an analyst to discuss further on what this really means and how the private sector can play its part, let's take a listen to President Tumwanandi Ndaitwah as she was speaking at the public-private forum that was held just last week.
Those 2 days we have been here have marked a strong beginning on the Namibia public-private forum. However, this forum will only have a real and lasting impact if each one of us individually and collectively does our part. We must act with discipline, urgency, diligence on what we have been discussing here. What stood out most over those 2 days was the unity of a nation. Striving for a common goal, as our founding president taught us, and definitely I'm convinced we will emerge victorious. I wish to thank all the participants, stakeholders, or presenters, stakeholders and participants for open discussions that guided our work in the past 2 days. The tone of the engagement showed that we can speak frankly, differ respectfully, and still move forward together. That spirit is of true partnership is what will carry Namibia from dialogue to delivery. During these 2 days, we reminded ourselves that progress starts with trust. And from the discussions, we have really shown that the government and the private sector, we trust one another. Because when government and business meet each other halfway, in the spirit of true partnership, we create the right environment for growth. During this forum, from all the statements delivered, the panels that took place, and the 10 working groups, a lot of issues came out. However, all of them were focusing on one direction, and that is, how do we grow our economy?
Great news! Impact just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Imba? Get all exclusive features for just 36 Namibian dollars a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything Imba has to offer at an unbeatable price. Imba, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
How do we grow our economy, create jobs, and take our people out of poverty? I must tell you that this engagement was served by able secretariat and a clear and comprehensive report will be produced immediately for implementation. Among the issues raised, just for a reflection, include over-regulations. We need to align regulations to enhance efficiency and productivities. The current processing of visa, work and import permits are considered not friendly to investment. It has also come out clear that we must make it easy to do business in Namibia by reviewing and amending policies that are hold us back, simplifying process, cutting unnecessary delays, and align our institutions. Equally, it comes to light that quality service delivery, honesty, and integrity are the key to success. We need a predictable and a fair system that builds confidence. And of course, as we know, confidence attracts investment, creates jobs, and drives inclusive growth. We agree Namibia needs to be competitive if we are to unlock our economy. Hence, the issue of incentives has been highlighted, as well as the importance of collaboration and to adopt a culture of agency. Skill and capacity building, as well as financing, are also important elements to enable us to reach to take our nation to prosperity. Namibia is part and parcel of the global village, and therefore connectivity and digitalization cannot be overemphasized. We agree that there is a need to align our education system with the needs of the labor market and equip our young people with practical and digital skills. In this way, we will build confidence, a confident generation ready to compete in the labor market. The high-level panels capture the essence of this forum, that the government cannot do everything alone. Real transformation happens when we create more space for private sector participation, while the government focuses on enabling, regulating, and ensuring fairness. This is how we move from potential to progress and from planning to prosperity. We also affected on the immense potential of our mining industry. Namibia is richly endowed with strategic minerals that the world needs. If well managed and sustained, mining can be a true game changer that lifts our economy to the new heights and improve the livelihood across the country. But to fully benefit, we must develop a specialized skills that this sector requires. Namibia must be equipped to take up the high-value jobs of the future rather than depending on outside experts. The United Nations participation added an important global dimension. Through the Global Accelerator on Jobs and Social Protection, Namibia is working hand in hand with international partners who share our vision of inclusive prosperity. There are four focus areas: youth employment, entrepreneurship, expansion of social protection, and transformation from informal to formal economy align seamlessly with our national priorities. The AU Agenda 2063, the Sustainable Development Goals, and the Pact for Future, adopted at the UN last year under co-facilitation of Namibia and Germany, is also an important document to refer to. Together, we must ensure that the public-private partnership, which we have recommitted ourselves over the past 2 days, delivers tangible results for our people. Our sectoral working group also brought forward practical and powerful ideas. The agriculture, water and fishery cluster reminded us that food security is both a matter of dignity and development. We must modernize agriculture, expand agro-processing, and promote Namibia's product to strengthen local industry. The creative industry, sports and tourism group reminded us that culture is also an economy. Our music, film, craft, and tourism hold immense potential to create jobs, build national pride, and share the Namibian story with the world. The public and private sector must collaborate closely to nature and invest in creative power. The session on health, housing, land and sanitation reminded us that inclusive development begins with dignity. access to quality health care, affordable housing, service delivery, and proper sanitation are not privilege, they are rights. We must act with urgency and unity to make those rights living reality for every Namibian. The question now, where do we go from here? To reduce the time of registering business in Namibia, I want to inform you that a decision is already taken that by the end of November, the one-stop shop must be up and running. It is going to be hosted at the old SME building bank. That's where the place is already cleaned, the furniture is available, and all ministers who are supposed to be there, they are already directed to make sure that senior officials are placed in that building without delay. And this has been the first task I had given to the Prime Minister, and he said he has delivered. So that is now off the table. I am also to inform you that all relevant ministries, they are directed to play their part. But for now, I want to inform you that, for example, the Ministry of Agriculture, with particular to the agricultural sector, they are directed to make sure that for them to ensure that the plant health capacity is enhanced before the end of this financial year, which is ending in April. They must be deploying specialized skills to address the emerging needs and the challenge of this sector.
And now, telephonically, we are joined in studio by analyst Saki Johannes. A very good afternoon to you, Saki, and welcome to On the Reading News Analysis.
Good afternoon.
Saki Johannes, we're talking about the private, public-private partnership forum that was held last week, and calling, of course, on private sectors and the public to play its part to ensure that Namibia is enhanced to well meet the goals that it has set for itself. Just exactly what role should the private sector play in helping to improve healthcare and housing delivery in Namibia?
What question? I think the private should be more on financing, mm-hmm. and also they can be more on construction, on the construction side, while the government then now can be on the regulatory side.
Mm. Interesting. As we are on this conversation about private sectors playing their part, when we are talking about private sectors, who exactly are we talking about, Johannes? Are we talking about the very big companies of private, or are we also including small companies? Who are we talking about?
Okay. Anything that is private is something that is not owned by the government. You know, our economic system is such in a way that it's a mixed economy. So by the way, we have companies that are 100% owned by individuals.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter whether the company is big or small, as long as it's owned by a person himself or by a group of people, mm-hmm. but it doesn't like owned by the government, then that one is what we consider as a private sector.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, of course, one of the major sectors that they are, or the key sectors that they are, that this PPF is looking at is quality health, housing, land, and sanitation. Now, in terms of housing, which I think is something that a lot of people are really eager to hear what the government has to say in terms of housing. And of course, the government said it plans to include delivering 50,000 affordable homes by 2029. Now, we get a lot of people that sometimes can have a good job with a really good salary, but just getting a house right here in Namibia is very, very, very expensive. So in terms of this goal by the government to deliver 50,000 affordable homes by 2029, considering that now that'll be, is it 3 years from now? Yeah, 3 years from now. Do you think this is something that is tangible? And perhaps, could the government look to urban areas? Because of course, a lot of people are moving from the rural areas to the urban areas in order to, better their livelihood.
I think, first of all, for something to work, there must be a clear way, a clear goal on how are we going to do it. You know, in many cases, we say, no, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, but the question is, how are you going to do this?
Yeah.
If the how question is answered, then we, I think it's possible. We can answer the not like now that we have involved in private sectors, and then in the private sector, that way we have companies that are building houses. And then if the government has a good agreement with those companies that build houses, then it will be fast.
I like how you say that, that if the government partners up with those companies that build houses, probably private companies that build houses, it will be fast. But I'm not, I don't want to completely agree with you on that aspect. You know, I like to say I live in Greenwell, Matongo, and it took, and so the city of Windhoek had the responsibility to dismantle the tarred road that was in Greenwell, Evelyn Street. And therefore, private companies, I guess, were sought. And they got the tender, company got the tender, and they had to put interlocks in that. And they started beginning of the year, and up until now, they are not done. Okay, they've made quite some improvement, but they have been quite very slow. Sincerely speaking, of course, we all have our part to play for a better Namibia. Every company that gets a tender, every company that has to do service has its part to play. And I just lost him now. Let me try and call him back.
Lipura nengeno wapungwa eva tere ulikoni maundu tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwele kutete opoewe ekukulile. Oshafafana nongeshefa ili mehola mo ihewe kike kovano ile koshiwana. Onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu kwa ndado ili nawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka. Opone ushendife nawa nukumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge Fanona, Monica, Co, Eagle FM, Honore Tatime, Bali Heali, Nola Natu, Heali Bali, No Heali, Ileko, Berewa, Murahetatu Natu, Bali O Hetatu Matatu, Oma Felane, Eagle FM, the Eye.
Okay, and Saki's online now. Saki Joannes, of course, good to have you back. So I was saying about how it took quite a long time from the beginning of the year up until now. It wasn't exactly, I think, in January, but then it was around about the beginning of the year up until now, and they still haven't finished the road just to putting interlocks, which I think, of course, there's a lot of work that goes in it, but I don't think it's necessary for it to take that much of a long time. So in terms of private companies having their part to play, because it is us, the civil servants or the public who often like to complain how the government is not delivering on certain aspects. And I want to also think that perhaps sometimes in one way or another, we are also the government. So in terms of companies that then do get to play their part, you know, and of course also have to be funded and be given some money, what is your message to them for them to be able to deliver and to deliver on time and to deliver efficiently and not just do the work for the sake of just doing it?
First of all, I think we have to look at who are those companies. Because in many cases, the company can be connections that a person professionals, but the company is capable of service delivery on time, like that you're saying. So we have now to identify the companies that can do the job on time. For example, you see, we have companies that can complete the job that is just mentioned now, the example that is just given now. There are companies that can do that within maybe even, let me say, 2 months or a month. Because they are capable of doing that. But now you have companies that are not capable of doing that, but they are being given tenders because they are linked, you know, to some individuals who are well known. And then that's where the issue of poor service delivery comes from, because we are giving tenders to companies that don't have the capability to deliver.
I hear you. Do you think we should continue to give perhaps opportunities to emerging companies, or perhaps give them much more, maybe work that we think they are manageable, they are able to manage, and give the bigger chunk to the bigger guys, because then we have built some trust in the bigger guys that they will deliver? Or should we perhaps just still fairly and equally, and allow people maybe to delay in a way, but also learn from it? What's your take on that?
Question.
In this
regard, that you know, when you talk of companies that can deliver and companies that cannot deliver, we should also look at Namibian companies. You know, there are those companies that, okay, this company is a Namibian company, and then, of course, we want to help, or we want to give tenders to our companies, the local ones. But in many cases, these companies don't have the ability to deliver, and then that's where the issue of poor service delivery comes from. However, my idea would be that let's give the big tenders to the companies that can able to complete the work, or can do the job on time.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't have such companies in Namibia, maybe it's time now that we should, or company owners should now consider expanding their companies so that they can be getting such jobs. Also, to the foreign companies, we should also learn how to cooperate with foreign companies and then to get the job done on time.
Saki Johannes, what incentives would you say would attract private investment into land servicing and affordable housing? What incentives would you say would best attract private investment into land servicing and also affordable housing?
I think first of all, you know, we are in the world of capital. I think we should consider capital. Do we have enough capital that we can put up there that will attract? Because sometimes it's a business. So
yes,
we can't do business without money. So we must make sure that we have enough money available for the private sector to come. Because in many cases, private sector does not operate like public sector. In private sector, in many cases, is that, and then that's part of our structure, part of what we have, like what I said at the beginning, that we are a mixed economy country. So some of those private companies, they are operating on a capitalistic way. So their main aim is profit. So we should now make sure that if we are able to partner with them,
mm-hmm.
at least there is something to get out of that. Though sometimes some companies can also help us. Some companies will be like, okay, now I'm willing to give to the public. I'm willing to give back to the people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's one of them. We must just make sure that money is available. And at the end of the day, these companies have something for them to get out of.
Indeed. Now, in terms of servicing low-income housing, or let me step away from that. How rather can informal settlements be formalized without displacing existing residents, or how can they be formalized in a way that doesn't disadvantage those ones that are already existing on that place?
I think first of all, our government, administration, but throughout town and side. But like what you said, we have an issue of urbanization. I think first of all, we must tackle the issue of urbanization first. We must make sure that at rural areas, at least we create job opportunities that side, so that people can stay that side and not migrating to the cities anymore, to towns, you know, in the city anymore. That's first of all. And then secondly, if we are trying now to formalize the informal settlement, I think we really need to think critically and then come up with a policy on how we can make houses affordable to our people, the low-income people. You know, there was an example of an apartheid government. People say, no, some of these apartheid government policies, they were bad, but as long as they were bad, there were some good things, because back then, we never had informal settlements the way we have them today. So what went wrong? I think we should go back to consider how can we make houses affordable to people who have low income. That's the question that we need to answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think the rent, is it rent-buy model, something like that? I'm not sure how it's properly called. Yeah. The rent, it's as if you're renting, but it's you own the place, but you know the money, sort of like the money you would pay on rent, you are now paying towards your house. Do you think that could also work?
I think, yeah. That can work. You know, we have people that are, I don't want to say they are suffering, but we have people that are paying rent that is equivalent to someone who can pay a house.
Who's even already paying a house.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So if you put that amount together, at the end of the year or at the end of 5 years, that person could be done with paying their houses.
True.
But now they are paying rent, and then when you lose your job, you go home. But if you could have been paying your house, when you lose your job, at least you have a house.
Exactly.
But now we are having such a situation. I think that's going to work.
Yeah.
And also, maybe government can give subsidies to people so that people can afford to buy houses.
Yes. I think we should also start there. Now, what accountability mechanisms would you say should be in place in order to track progress on those targets? It's well enough to release some documents and say we're going to do this and whatnot. Of course, it's the new government; it's business unusual, and let's keep that that optimism. But then, what accountability mechanisms or measurements would you say can help us in the long run to fast track to say, are we on the right path? Are we making some progress? Are we getting there? How far behind are we with what we said we're going to deliver?
I think first of all, when it comes to accountability, that's where we are weak. You mentioned something that we can document, yes, that says we must do this and this. But we only tell people, no, we have these documents that we are going to do A, B, C, D. But we don't report to people that, okay, we say this necessarily. Sometimes we do, but in many cases, we don't do that. So one of the mechanisms that we can use is that if we say we are saying, okay, fine, we are going to build, let me say, 100 houses in 5 months or so, any time frame that we can give, then you make sure that after 1 year, then you come back to the people and say, you report back on the house that we built. So we must first have that mechanism of track record. We must track record what you have done in a certain period of time that we have promised people that we are going to do that. And then secondly, something like a committee that is just responsible for checking that the money and all the resources that were spent according to how it was supposed to be spent. Because in many cases, we have 3 million, 5 million, or 100 million spent on a certain place, but we don't really put up a measure that, okay, this is how the money was spent, and then we come back to the people, and then we tell them, this is how we spend the money.
Mm-hmm.
We just say, no, that one costed 2 million. Mm-hmm. But what costed 2 million? Is it the roof? Is it
which
one?
Yes.
So I think that's what we need to put in place.
And why you are at that? I something interesting comes to my mind. You know, the roadblock that was constructed. Where was it in Ongwediva and between Oshakati and Ongwediva? I'm not so sure. I can't remember so where we were. Let me just say I think it was sometime last year. And just to hear the ridiculous amount of money that was said went into that, you begin to ask yourself, is it the zinc that cost a million, or what exactly? So I hear you when you say it's necessary, because at the end of the day, you want to be transparent and accountable to the people you are serving, to tell them that we spent 500,000 on this, 20,000 went to this, and all that. And I think it also helps build trust. Not so?
Yes. I think that's the case that we have, that we are just told, no, this one costed this one costed this amount, but we don't ask which one exactly that costed that amount of money. That's an issue that we have. Because in many cases, I just want to give an example. of something that was on circulating. Mm-hmm. But you remember there was a story of in Parliament,
yeah,
whereby parliamentarians want to buy biscuits that cost 2 million, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, yeah. That was that was to be
so
in the. It was. Pardon
does
me.
It make sense?
Let me add some clarity on that, and then of course okay. We can go further into it. Those biscuits apparently were meant for when she has guests, the Prime Minister, what the Speaker of the Parliament has guests, and to the tune of 2 million, that is cool drinks and cookies. I still think it's quite a heavy amount of money. Perhaps maybe 500,000 could have been sufficient. Yeah, you were saying.
Those are the issues that we have to question, like, what type of biscuits that can cost that whole amount? What type? And how many cases, maybe, for how long are they going to be kept? Or is it just a year? I think we need to question, instead of just saying, no, we put 100 million here, but we have to question, like, does this worth that amount that we spend on?
Mm. Johannes, Saki Johannes, thank you so much for making time for us right here on the Reader News Analysis. I do appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Okay. And with that, we pause here now and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back shortly with more right here on the Reader News Analysis. See you.
Save and win at WB in the Pick a Box birthday promo. Enter today with your Smart Buy card. Get 4 kg Cadilla mixed chicken for $189.99, 1 kg Pasta Grande spaghetti for $19.99, 750 gram Nola mayo for just $37.99, and 2 kg Sunlight hand wash powder for only $52.99. Learn more about Pick a Box at www.vurmanbrock.com. T's and C's apply. We care.
You've leveled up in life, and now it's time to level up your contact. MTC is changing the game with our new contract data plans. More data, more voice minutes, and more SMSs. Core of everything you need. Plans start from just $199 per month. And for a limited new customer's score, an extra 10 gigabytes of data valid for 90 days, absolutely free. Don't wait. Visit any MTC mobile home or call 1-2-000 to level up today. MTC, make the connection.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud. So
not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the
eye.
Welcome back. The 8th Rundu annual trade fair officially opened this week, showcasing a strong turnout of local and international exhibitors. Now, speaking at the opening ceremony is Francisca Kupembona, the strategic executive for community services at the Rundu Town Council, whereby she announced that this year's edition features 206 stalls and 168 exhibitors, including 7 international participants from Tanzania, Kenya, and Cameroon. Exhibitors from across Namibia are also taking part, representing a wide range of industries and services. Kupembona highlighted that the trade fair continues to serve a vital platform for business networking, regional trade promotion, and community engagement. She added that the Rundu Town Council is proud to host representative from its sister towns, Rakana and Oshakati, with whom Rundu shares twining agreements focused on the exchange of ideas in local governance and service delivery. Now, the Rundu Trade Fair has grown into one of the Kavango East region's key economic events, providing opportunities for entrepreneurs, small and medium enterprises, and investors to connect, showcase innovation and explore new markets. Let's now take a listen to Francisca Coupe Mbona.
Part of this ceremony, we are able to view the stalls and view all other products and services that are being exhibited here. So as an organizing committee, we are really, really grateful that under his leadership, we have managed to pull through this mammoth task, a great event that we celebrate today. This platform continues to serve as a shining example of a strategic decision and serves as a platform to discuss the importance of local economic development and what are our roles on how we can collectively contribute to the growth of our beloved town of Rundu and our country Namibia as well. Ladies and gentlemen, what started in the early 2000s as Kavango Summer Festival by private individuals in collaboration with the former Rundu Urban Constituency Councillor Honorable Nimrod Mureni, for those of us that have been around, we do know him, and we will cherish his initiative, and that brought about the birth of the Rundu Annual Trade Fair, which we started organizing as from 2016. This event has grown from a small community exhibition into a major regional event that attracts business, investors, government ministries, and visitors from all parts of Namibia and neighboring countries. Year on year, we continue to make significant strides in terms of attraction to the trade fair. In this regard, we are pleased to report that this year we have managed to attract 206 stalls that have been occupied by 168 exhibitors, compared to last year, where we had 133 exhibitors.
Mm-hmm. President Lucia Witbooi has underscored the importance of platforms that promote economic growth and community development. Now, during the official opening of the 8th Rundu Annual Trade Fair on Tuesday, Witbooi said the trade fair provides a vital space for small, medium and large enterprises to showcase their products, attract investment and build networks that strengthen both local and national economies. It is here where creativity meets opportunity and where communities come together to shape their future, she said. The vice president described Rundu as not only the commercial hub of the Kavango East region, but also one of Namibia's fastest growing towns, strategically positioned along the Kavango River and broadening the Angola town of Kalai. She highlighted the town's vast potential in agribusiness, tourism, culture, logistics, housing, fisheries, renewable energy, and manufacturing, saying continued investment could transform Rundu into a regional hub for trade and development. Witbooi reaffirmed government's commitment to supporting initiatives that promote grassroots economic growth. Through platforms like the Rundu Annual Trade Fair, we strengthen local economies, promote entrepreneurship, create employment, and stimulate cross-border trade. The building blocks of resilience, prosperity, and national unity, she said. She further urged the business community to seize opportunities, innovate, and collaborate to drive industries that will improve livelihoods across nations. Let's now take a listen to the Vice President of Namibia, that is Lucia Witbooi.
The commercial hub and capital of the Kavango East region, but also one of Namibia's fastest growing towns and gateway of commerce and cooperation. Strategically located along the mighty Kavango River and neighboring the Angolan town of Kalai. The town's potential in agribusiness, tourism, culture, logistics, housing, fisheries, renewable energy, and manufacturing is vast. With continued investment, Rundu can become a regional hub of trade and development that benefits not only the people of this region, but the entire Namibian nation. The government of the Republic of Namibia remains steadfast in supporting initiatives that drives our economic development. That's why I am here today, as I said, we had a very hectic programs, but I just decided I cannot cancel or ask the governor to step in for us. So that's why I make efforts to be. Because I said I cannot disappoint my people, my Namibian people, my Kabongo people. That's why I'm here. We recognize that sustainable growth begins at the grassroots in our towns, villages, and communities. Through platforms like the Room to Annual Trade Fair, we strengthen our local economies, promote entrepreneurship, create employment, and stimulate cross-border trade. These are the building blocks of resilience, prosperity, and national unity. I therefore call upon the business community to seize the opportunity that this trade fair presents. Let us innovate, collaborate, and invest in the industries that will transform our economy and improve the livelihood of our families and our people. We would also like to encourage the regional leadership to ensure that this trade fair is supported wholeheartedly, as it not only benefits the local economy of the town, but to a larger extent, the region itself. It is through these opportunities that jobs are created and the livelihood of our communities is improved. To our exhibitors, I encourage you. So next year we must have more than 206. Like from last year we have increased, so let us increase 250 to 300 next year. Ne? I encourage you to showcase the best of your talents, products, and innovations. The main goals of trade fairs are to promote products and services, create business connections, very important, create business connections and increase sales. While you are there at your store, don't just stay there. It's opportunities to connect. Visit the next store, visit the other one, visit the other one. Ask questions so that when you close, you connect the dots. It also provides a platform for entrepreneurs to showcase their goods, launch new products, and strengthen their brand image. Therefore, let your work inspire others.
And with that, we pause here now and take a trip to the marketplace. We won't be long before you know it, we'll retain and tell you what's making headlines in terms of economic indicators thereafter. Trading Economics. Stay tuned.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa eva tere uliko ni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe kutete okoye ekukurile oshafa fana nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano hile koshiwana onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitida mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshefa omarudi kayo loka opone ushendi fenawa nokumona oijabo ili nawa ninge pata fanona monika ko Eagle FM onora itatimwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile konderewa mura hetatu natu bali o hetatu watatu oma filane Eagle FM the eye.
you know, the University of Namibia Alumni Association is hosting its elective annual general meeting on 5th November this year. Nominations are now open and will be closing on 13 October 2025. Pardon me on that. Did you know the University of Namibia Alumni Association will host its elective annual general meeting on Wednesday, the 5th of November 2025 at 17:30? Well, the meeting will be held virtually, allowing alumni to join from all corners of the world. All UNAM alumni are invited to be part of this important occasion as we reflect on their achievements, discuss key motions, and elect a new executive committee. AGM link will be shared closer to the date and all reports will be available on the UNAM website. Don't miss this opportunity to connect and shape the alumni legacy.
Goeie nuus, Skimbad nou nog beter geword. Ons het splinternuwe funksies bygevoeg om jou ervaring vinniger, beter en kragtiger te maak as ooit tevore. Is jy gereed om die volle potensiaal van Skimbad te geniet? Kry alle eksklusiewe funksies vir slegs $36 per maand of spaar selfs meer met ons spesiale intekenplanne. 5% afslag vir 'n 3 maande intekening, 10% afslag vir 'n 6 maande intekening en 25% afslag vir 'n 12 maande intekening. Kies die beste plan vir jou werk en geniet al die voordele wat Kimba bied teen 'n onverbeterlike prys. Kimba, waar die wêreld saamkom, laai dit af en teken vandag aan.
Get the best for less at USave. 2 kilograms Omaeta cultured milk, just $48.99 Namibian dollars. 2 liters of Rietfontein nectar juice, just $34.99 Namibian dollars. 500 grams of King Polony, just $24.99 Namibian dollars. Knorr packet soup, $30 Namibian for any 5. That's just $6 Namibian each. Take a break with Nestle Kit Kat chocolates, just $10.99 Namibian dollars. And a 2 liter Co-E cool drink, only $12.99 Namibian dollars. USave, your low budget grocery store. Where good food costs less.
Welcome back, and now for economic indicators and trading economics. $1 today is equals to 17 Namibian dollars and 11 cents. 1 Swiss franc is equals to 21 Namibian dollars and 28 cents. 1 pound sterling is equals to 22 Namibian dollars and 54 cents. 1 Australian dollar is equals to 11 Namibian dollars and 22 cents. 1 Botswana pula is equals to $1 Namibian and 29 cents. And with that, let's now move over to trading economics. The Central Bank of Botswana raised its benchmark interest rate by 160 basis points to 3.5% during its regular meeting held on October 30, 2025. Now, this marked the first rate hike since June 2022, bringing borrowing costs to their highest since March 2022 amid signs of stronger inflationary pressures. Now, the annual inflation rate in Botswana accelerated for the second month to 3.7% in September 2025, the highest since August 2024 from 1.4% in the previous month. German stocks spurred some early gains to trade slightly negative around 24,060 on Thursday as traders weighed fresh corporate earnings and economic data while awaiting the upcoming ECB's decision. Meanwhile, investors reacted cautiously to the trade agreement reached between the United States and China as previous stocks have seen setbacks and key issues such as chips were left out. Now, on the data front, the German economy unsurprisingly stagnated in the third quarter of 2025, following an upwardly revised 0.2% contraction in the second quarter. That is according to preliminary estimates. October inflation figures are due later in the day, with analysts anticipating a slight slowdown among equities, Dutch telecom-led losses, and concerns over its subsidiary T-Mobile US after Verizon CEO announced plans to re-enter the US market. Volkswagen retreated down 1.5% after promoting or reporting its first quarterly loss in 5 years. Industrial production in Cyprus rose by 0.8% year-on-year in August 2025, easing from a 1.8% increase in the previous month. Now, this marked the weakest growth in industrial activity since a contraction in November 2024, as output slowed for manufacturing at 1.7% was 3.9%, and water supply and materials recovery at 3.3% versus 8.2%. Now that's what we had for you today in terms of economic indicators and trading economics. We pause here now and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back with news beyond the borders of Namibia. Stay tuned.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM,
the eye. Oshafa fana nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwan. Kono ngeshe fa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka. Okupitira oipindi konu honda daily nawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe fa omarudi dayo loka. Okone ushendi fenawa nukumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge pata fano na Monica ko Eagle FM. Onore za tuimwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile kongerewa, mura hetatu natu, bali o hetatu watatu, o mafelane, Eagle FM, the eye.
And now for news beyond the borders of Namibia, we're starting off in South Africa where they're talking about Africa's infrastructure development is rigging.
The lack of energy infrastructure, road networks,
food security,
railways, and digital and data infrastructure creates inequalities on the continent. This is according to the African leaders who have converged in Luanda to discuss how best to handle the matter. Addressing the summit, Angolan President and AU Chairperson João Lourenço said young people must take the lead with new innovations to deal with the lack of adequate infrastructure in Africa.
We must identify the best and most effective solution for financing rail, port and airport, energy and telecommunication infrastructure, not only to serve each country individually, but above all, so these infrastructure could be shared amongst countries in the context of regional and continental integration.
The AU Commission Chairperson, Mahmoud Ali Youssef, has called on the private sector on the continent to come on board and invest in infrastructure development to address unequal access to basic needs.
A structured mobilization of the African private sector as a central actor of transformation, a coordinated and substantial access to climate financing, notably through the Alliance for Green Infrastructure Africa, which could mobilize more than $500 million in its first phase. Yes, indeed, what we are building here are not roads and bridges. We are building an Africa that is connected, confident, sovereign, capable of asserting itself as a pole of balance and creativity in the world to come.
The AU Development Agency Audi Nepad CEO Nados Bekele Thomas says that the infrastructure crisis is an existential threat to the development of the continent.
The lesson from Dakar is clear. We can no longer treat financing as a fragmented marketplace of scattered deals. We must transform it into a unified strategy where member states strategically fund our development finance institutions, and our development finance institutions in turn channel that capital into priority bankable projects. We must commit to supporting our development finance institutions by giving them the necessary scale and by ensuring that our development finance institutions are granted preferred credit status.
The three-day summit will wrap up on Thursday with the outcomes expected to be implemented in line with the AU's vision of 2063, where no one will be left behind. Dita Botsotetsi, SABC News in Luanda, Angola.
Meanwhile, young people are said to be reshaping Africa's politics.
Resources on the continent. Don't just sit, think twice. There is quite some emotion on the continent about why should Africa be poor in development, yet with all these natural resources. It's a serious debate. Why are we poor? Indeed, Africa is poorest, you know it. Yet it is endowed with the most vast resources, whichever sector. And of course, DRC is always quoted, but every other country. I think usually in change management, and I know you do a lot of change management, it's better to realize the need for change and initiate it yourselves so that it takes the course that suits you, your own interest, than to wait to be told out, you, we are taking this, we are nationalizing this mine. You look forward and say, okay, these are the threats. Because the youth, this quoting code, General Z, Gen Z, that thing, I think, is maybe bad, even for the mining sector. Because the young generation in Africa is 65-66% under 25, we are the youthful continent. But the youth have no opportunities anymore. You know it very well. I was graduating in thousands, but maybe only 1% go into any form of employment. And there's that emotion. And what happened in Madagascar 3-4 weeks ago, I think it's something that we should learn from. The youth are now leading revolutions and removing heads of state, because they are saying, you people, you are in power. We have natural resources. We, the youth, we are not benefiting anything. You are useless, out. And people still refer to mines and minerals. Why are we poor when we have all these new minerals that the minister mentioned here?
You know, we find that our kids that are the born free, we call them the born free because in South Africa, the kids that are 31 years of age were born in 1994. So they say, we are born free. Then they look at people like Ibrahim Traore, and they look at what's happening in Madagascar, and the kids are saying, we want procedure to happen beyond the liberation of our country, if political liberation. What about the economic liberation? So the children will be the future. And Africa is an unstoppable future. Those strategic minerals that we have in Africa, what we need to do, we need to have an integrated approach to protect our minerals. And look at what is it that we're going to do in terms of making sure that manufacturing must be done locally. You're only going to give a license to trade to anybody who wants to build a mine that is going to go and manufacture within the country.
Zambia moves to regulate license and digital marketers.
The rapid growth of advertising and online marketing in Zambia has brought with it a mix of creativity and concern, from bold digital campaigns to billboards crowding city streets. It's against this backdrop that the Zambia Institute of Marketing, ZIM, is taking steps to regulate the industry. Starting next year, content creators offering advertising services and online marketing agencies will be required to obtain licenses. ZIM Registrar and Chief Executive Officer Danny Chanda says the initiative is part of a new code of business practice developed to guide advertising agencies.
Anybody, an advertising agency, a salesperson working in there, whoever is communicating a product. So if you're communicating your products online, you are doing marketing. And by law, you should be register with Zambia Institute of Marketing, you should have a practicing license.
Mr. Chanda has urged stakeholders to engage with the institute and register before the new regulations take effect.
We are actually encouraging people to come forward now before the regulation gets enforced, before we go into January. Would like people to come forward now and share their business practice, what is it that they are doing, and we advise them what level of membership they can get from the Zambia Institute of Marketing.
ZIM President Mo Wavesa has expressed concern over the placement of some billboards across the country.
We've seen a clutter of billboards all over. We have also seen billboards being placed in the wrong places. When I say wrong places, for example, if you're advertising alcohol, you're advertising cigarettes, you're advertising things like gambling. Those should not take place, should not be happening in the confines of learning institutions.
The institute is also working to regulate billboard advertising and ensure responsible placement of advertisement. Alice Lubasi, ZNBC News, Lusaka.
Uganda strengthens its fight against wildlife trafficking.
The canine conservation program began in 2016, placing sniffer dogs at Entebbe International Airport and key conservation areas. Since then, the unit has recovered hundreds of illegally trafficked wildlife products.
We use the dogs to detect wildlife trophies and products from passenger bags and cargo. So we've seen a great reduction in the numbers of confiscations that we've had over time.
Uganda was once listed among the gang of 8 countries for wildlife crime, but authorities say they are determined to turn the tide. Behind me, a sniffer dog is screening passenger luggage, part of Uganda's frontline defense against wildlife trafficking. These canine teams are trained to detect even the faintest of ivory, rhino horn, or pangolin scales hidden in transit. Traffickers are constantly adapting, finding new ways to hide wildlife products. The canine unit has had to adapt just as quickly, refining their training and detection techniques to stay ahead.
We also do personnel training where we learn new techniques of concealment, how the traffickers are evolving, to try by all means to be either the same pace with them or ahead of them. We understand that the globe is always changing and people are adapting to new methods, concealment techniques and stuff.
With tougher laws, a dedicated wildlife court and growing regional cooperation, Uganda is strengthening its defenses. For the canine teams, it's a race against time where every sniff counts.
We have seen around 56 cases being successfully prosecuted. Okay, we had a landmark case in 2022. Where someone was found in possession of ivory, and this person was sent to life in prison. Now this person is serving, because the law is very clear. It makes heavier penalties for people involved in wildlife crime. The Wildlife Act, Cap 315. You can be sentenced up to life in prison. Person can be made to pay a fine of up to 20 billion Uganda shillings. This is not small money.
From airport checkpoints to conservation areas, Uganda's canine unit is proving that even small noses can make a difference in protecting endangered species. Mike Obalekesi, GTN, Kampala.
Still in Uganda, Uganda boosts its efforts in order to reduce maternal death.
This is one of the most rewarding moments for Divine Bwanika. For nearly 13 years, she's been helping mothers deliver safely at Chibuli Muslim Hospital in Kampala, and helping to bring a new life into the world gives her immense satisfaction, delivering close to 10 babies a day.
You think that it's not going to come out well, but as soon as the baby is born, the baby cries loudly. That is my greatest joy, to see the mother going home with her baby.
Divine's fight to ensure safe delivery is sometimes a tough one. She's encountered mothers who come in with complications of severe bleeding. It's one of the leading causes of death during delivery, with 34% of maternal deaths in Uganda caused by severe bleeding.
In a hospital like this, all the essential medical tools required to manage emergencies are available. But when mothers arrive too late, the situation often turns tragic. Even with the right equipment, doctors sometimes can't save them.
It's Divine's worst nightmare, losing a mother on the delivery table after all options fail.
That is my worst moment. I don't want to see a mother dying because I feel there's nothing I can do. More so when they come, when they have bled, she's severe, anemic. These are times we try. We try and do the resuscitation, we give oxygen, we give blood. And not until we fail, but we keep trying.
Some mothers choose to deliver from home, often with the help of a traditional birth attendant. Home births, however, can put their lives at risk from complications that need advanced medical intervention. Antenatal checkups can reduce complications like severe bleeding by identifying risk factors.
Every mother will bleed, but if you're anemic and then you bleed, that might actually take your life. So it is important for all antenatal mothers, when they go for antenatal, they receive some medication to replace the blood levels so that they are strong enough.
Doctors say severe bleeding during or after birth can be managed in big hospitals if mothers arrive early. Medically, the complication is caused by tears during delivery or failure for the uterus to contract adequately after birth.
All that preparation takes place during antenatal. And when you reach the facility is able to give you the drugs which reduce. Because if that is done, then you are able to reduce about 60% of all the mothers who die. They get a drug which reduces the bleeding, helps the uterus to contract.
The Ministry of Health is training health workers to diagnose and manage the condition and equipping facilities with drugs to stop bleeding. But most importantly, regular hospital checkups during pregnancy will ease the work of midwives like Divine. Isabel Nakiria, CGTN Kampala, Uganda.
Nigeria launches carbon market activation in order to boost its green economy.
Across rural Nigeria, farmers like Aliyu Haruna are helping the country plant the seeds of a new kind of green economy, one where sustainable agriculture can generate carbon credits and new income. Through a partnership between the government and agri-tech firm Thrive Agric, smallholders are being supported to adopt climate-smart practices to enhance their yields and engage in carbon sequestration and boost yields.
I have recorded much progress. First, my yields increased. The fields are stronger and better, and the nutrients in the soil intact. Before, when we farmed, we used too much fertilizer, and the yield wasn't as favorable.
Thrive Agric already works with close to 1 million farmers across 22 states, 40% of them women. Their yields are often three times higher than the national average, thanks to improved farming and soil management.
Regenerative practices that have seen carbon sequester, such that such soil being utilized can then be utilized even better for other planting seasons. So this has essentially increased soil efficiency. We've also taken engagements on agroforestry, practicing silviculture, where the traditional form of planting is involved with growing trees, and in this case, economic trees, such as fruity trees, neem, and trees that can fetch additional income for farmers. It is that by so doing, there is also carbon sequestration that helps soil health improve, as well as provide additional incomes for the farmers.
Carbon credits help a farmer's yield grow by incentivizing and financing sustainable practices that improve soil health. These practices, such as using cover crops, capture carbon in the soil, which leads to increased fertility, better water retention, and reduced erosion. Farmers can then sell the resulting carbon credits to generate revenue, which can be reinvested in their farms and provide additional income beyond crop sales. Nigeria's carbon markets activation policy development under the African Carbon Markets Initiative is part of broader plans to finance its energy transition plan, which needs over $410 billion to reach net zero emissions by 2060. Agriculture offers one of the fastest ways to generate verified carbon credits while improving food security and livelihoods.
With carbon credit generation, we find out that there is a lot of opportunity there, providing energy like cooking gas and the stove, converting so many things into use. And it has become a very good opportunity for agriculture, especially when we come to increasing the yield of agriculture. Because when you make use of the carbon, you reduce the waste and every other thing, you'll find out that the environment where plants can grow can also be fresh, not just fresh, but also be green.
If fully implemented, Nigeria's carbon markets could mobilize billions in green investments, support millions of rural jobs, and ensure farmers are part of Africa's growing climate economy, not just as participants, but as real beneficiaries. Kelechi Emekalam, CGTN Abuja, Nigeria.
And now for some international news, Trump lowers tariffs on China and ends a rare earth roadblock after his meeting with China's President Xi Jinping.
President Trump has described his meeting with China's President Xi Jinping as amazing, saying that they made a series of outstanding decisions to avert a spiraling trade war. Speaking to reporters on his flight home from South Korea, President Trump said that some tariffs would be reduced and that sales of advanced computer chips to Beijing were on the agenda. In return, President Xi had agreed to lift restrictions on rare earth mineral exports for a year. Now, they're vital for the manufacture of cars, planes and weapons. He also agreed to curb production of the drug fentanyl. Well, here's President Trump speaking to reporters on Air Force One.
I thought it was an amazing meeting. He's a great leader of a very powerful, very strong country, China. And what can I say? We have, it was an outstanding group of decisions, I think, that was made. A lot of decisions were made. There wasn't too much left out there.
Donald Trump there. Well, let's cross over to my colleague Steve Lai, who is in Gyeongju. And Steve, the president saying the meeting was amazing. The decisions were outstanding. Just how amazing was it?
Yeah, well, he was asked 1 out of 10 how he would rate the meeting, and he said 12. So that gives you an impression about how he thinks it went. Certainly, he's been very positive about it since he spoke on Air Force One. Those comments that we heard from him were straight after the meeting. When he left the meeting, he went straight into Air Force One and departed South Korea. Now, we have heard more from President Trump. I'll just run you through what he's been saying on social media regarding some of the outcomes of that meeting. He says our farmers will be very happy, saying China will start buying massive amounts of soybeans and sorghum and other farm products, as well as American energy from Alaska. He also says that China has agreed to continue the flow of rare earth materials, as you mentioned, Kasia, and that they will help us end the fentanyl crisis, he says. There is enormous respect between the two countries. Now, just a reminder, China has not confirmed some of the measures mentioned by the U.S. president. Well, for more on this, I'm joined by Jake Kwan, our South Korea correspondent, who's been watching developments here with me in Gyeongju. Jake, talk us through some of the responses that we have heard from some of the spokespeople from China with regards to this meeting.
Well, China said that there is now a consensus on a lot of these trade issues, but they have also shared some of the details, largely confirming and echoing what President Trump has told the reporters on the Air Force One, namely that there will be a suspension of the rare earth mineral exports measures that they were going to bring in, which would have effectively throttled the export of these very critical resources for modern manufacturing. This is a critical resource that goes into, you know, magnets, as well as any kind of state-of-the-art art, machinery that would have been critical for President Trump's, really, his goal of revitalizing American manufacturing. So that was the sticking point in this impasse of a trade dispute. And we heard that that is going to go away for a year. And we also heard that, you know, that there will be an immediate lowering of the American taxes on Chinese imports for 10%, as well as we heard that China is expecting America to suspend for a year this measure that they had against Chinese shipbuilding or anything shipping-related industries. So the theme we're hearing here is that all these harsh economic measures that were made to hurt each other's economies will be going away for a year. Now, of course, after a year, you know, we'll have to see if this can become a more permanent solution. I think going into today's meeting, a lot of people are optimistic that there could be some kind of a deal, but nobody was under the impression that this would be the end of the trade war. Instead, it feels more like a truce, and we'll really have to see whether the ink can be put on the paper, which will really be the point where we can say there is an agreement.
Yeah, and trade deals and trade agreements often take time. They're not often negotiated in 90 days, as President Trump had hoped for. Now, President Trump did say that he is expecting to meet with President Xi Jinping next year in April in a trip to China. So the two leaders have spoken. They look like they will be speaking again in times to come. But in terms of the meetings here in Guangzhou at the APEC summit, President Trump has now left South Korea. President Xi Jinping has now arrived. So just quickly, Jake, there's still quite a few more days to go, and President Xi Jinping will have center stage.
Yes. So President Xi Jinping is going to stay here for 3 days at the APEC summit. This is an annual gathering of 21 countries. And President Xi Jinping, his schedule is not all, you know, shared with the reporters at this point, but he's expected to deliver some kind of speech on the 31st with the leaders. And this is essentially a stage for him to brush shoulders with all these world leaders to talk about trade as well as perhaps security. Now, what is really notable here is the absence of President Donald Trump. Normally, the American president would be attending these meetings, but he chose not to stay for that main event, and instead he has returned to America today. So instead, we'll see the Chinese leader filling that room, being the biggest man in the room, and brushing shoulders with America's traditional allies and other leaders.
Yeah, thanks very much, Jake, for getting us across that. Jake Kwon there, our Seoul correspondent. So, as you mentioned, President Trump has now left. President Xi Jinping now takes center stage here in South Korea. And we can discuss this further with Meredith Crowley. She's a professor of economics at the University of Cambridge. Meredith, positive words, as we've seen from both sides. What's your key takeaway from the Trump-Xi meeting?
So this is a detente, which is a big win for the United States substantially and for the high-income West more generally, because China has agreed to allow the continued sale of rare earths. They're obligated to do that under the World Trade Organization. So, you know, that's good. In return, the U.S. is probably going to get, you know, very little in the way of soybean purchases would be my expectation. There was a trade war. That trade war is still going on. Xi and Trump made it a lot worse in the summer since Trump took office, and now they've dialed things back. The thing the U.S. really wanted was this rare earths policy change. What China wanted was high, sophisticated memory chips. So these NVIDIA chips, other kinds of sophisticated technology, they didn't get that. What they got instead was a lot of press time with the American president saying how wonderful President Xi is. Xi can now play that in China. It looks like a win for him domestically. He can sell that as, I stood up to the U.S. and, you know, things are looking better for China now.
Now, I just want to welcome our viewers in the UK. If you're just joining us, I'm Steve Vai here in Guangzhou, and we are having a discussion with Meredith Crowley about the meetings that have taken place here in South Korea, where President Trump has met with President Xi Jinping on the sidelines of the APEC summit. Meredith, just to continue on, what do you see as the biggest challenges or the biggest obstacles between the two big superpowers, the US and China, when it comes to the various issues that they have?
Well, since President Obama was in office, the U.S. has had this kind of dual strategy of a pivot to Asia, wanting to strengthen its trade connections, its investment connections throughout Asia. But at the same time, they wanted to ring fence and contain China and keep China from having a deepening of its trade relationships with other partners in Asia. So if we look at everything that's happened in the last, you know, week or so in Asia, Trump has actually achieved in many ways things that President Obama was trying to achieve but wasn't able to deliver on. So, for example, these agreements Trump signed in Malaysia and in Cambodia, they've actually given U.S. tech companies a lot of power with their relationships with these countries. So basically, you know, everyone in the world that's not the U.S. wants to charge digital services taxes on e-commerce, you know, use of Google, advertising by Google, that kind of stuff, when it happens within their country. The U.S. doesn't want other countries taxing these big American companies in their own jurisdictions. So they don't want Canada imposing a digital service tax. They got Malaysia and Cambodia to agree not to do that. They also got these commitments that these countries will align with U.S. export controls that are security related. Read, they won't export the rare earths or the mineral chips to China if the U.S. says don't. They also got, the U.S. and Japan had this agreement where they said, you know, very light touch agreement, not substantial commitments, but both the U.S. and Japan are committed to using their own policy tools to reduce their reliance on China for rare earth minerals. This is a big deal because Japan makes the magnets that everyone in the world uses for all kinds of sophisticated technology. Japan has been reducing its reliance on China over the last several years. The U.S. is now sort of doing the same stuff Japan is doing. This past week, the Export-Import Bank of the U.S., which is part of the U.S. federal government, announced new investment initiatives in rare earth mining concerns in Australia. So altogether, Trump is, you know, trying to do very aggressively this contain China strategy, while at the same time shoring up and strengthening these commitments with other democracies in Asia. So I think in some ways he does need some credit for this aggressive stance has delivered some things that any American administration would have found valuable to the, you know, the state overall.
Meredith, we'll have to leave it there, but thanks so much for your insight and putting that in perspective for us. Meredith Connolly there, Professor of Economics at the University of Cambridge. So, Kash, as you can see, President Trump's trip to Asia has now come to an end, from Malaysia to Japan to here in South Korea. And now it's Xi Jinping's chance to come in to Korea for the APEC summit to see what deals he can make and what influence he will have on countries in this region.
Meanwhile, Fed cut rates for the second straight time to the lowest level in 3 years.
Breaking news, the Federal Reserve just making its decision on interest rates, and notably it's a decision that comes without critical economic data used by the central bank to make monetary policy.
Yeah, that would be helpful to have. Let's get to CNN's Matt Egan, who's at the Fed. Matt, obviously we're all awaiting this. What can you tell us?
Well, the Fed just delivered an interest rate cut, and it is the quarter point cut that was widely expected. So this is the second straight interest rate cut from the Fed, and it does lower Fed rates to the lowest level in 3 years. This shows that Fed officials are clearly more concerned about weakness in the job market than they are about stubborn inflation. Fed officials, in the statement that they just put out moments ago, they reiterated that risk to employment rose in recent months and that job gains have slowed this year. Now, what's unusual here with this decision is the fact that the Fed had to make it while flying mostly blind. Because of the government shutdown, many of the indicators that officials typically rely on were not available. That means that this was the first time since the Fed's rate-setting committee was established back in the 1930s that they had to decide on interest rates without the monthly jobs report. And the Fed statement, it did allude to this problem, which is a big problem for Fed officials that consider themselves data-dependent. There's just not much data out right now. But they did insert some new language that alluded to this. They, for instance, Fed officials said that available indicators suggest that economic activity has been expanding at a moderate pace. Previously, they said recent indicators. Also, Fed officials said that the unemployment rate has edged up but remained low through August. That's because we don't know what the unemployment rate was as of September. And in this statement, they also said that more recent indicators are consistent with these developments. That seems to be a reference to some of those private alternative economic numbers that get put out and that we know Fed officials look at. So what does all this mean for viewers at home? It does mean that borrowing costs are coming down. This is helpful for people who have credit card debt, home equity lines of credit as well. And I do think that this does show that right now the big focus for Fed officials remains on protecting the job market. They clearly are not as concerned about stubborn inflation. Boris and Brianna.
And Matt, what are you going to be listening for from Jay Powell, the Fed chair, when he speaks moments from now?
Well, first off, everyone wants to know, what is Fed Chair Jerome Powell thinking as far as an interest rate cut at the next meeting in December? And what about early next year? Also, what is Powell going to say about what are the economic indicators that he's looking at during this government shutdown? I'm interested to hear what he says about some AI-driven layoffs, such as the mass layoffs that we heard about from Amazon as well. And just one last point for you. This was not a unanimous decision. 10 officials, including Jerome Powell, voted in favor of this quarter point cut. One official voted for no change at all. That was Kansas City Fed President Jeffrey Schmid. And one official voted for an even bigger cut. Not surprisingly, that official is Fed Governor Stephen Miron. Back to you guys.
All right, Matt Egan at the Fed. Thank you.
Our business editor at large, Richard Quest, joins us now live as the news, of course, starting to break. And Richard, as you look through your email, good to see you. I know that markets were pricing in a 25 basis point, Richard. What are you seeing? I'm looking at my phone as well.
Yeah, it's gone. The Fed has lowered rates by a quarter of a percentage point. They did the same thing at the last meeting. And so they've now, the Fed, so-called Fed funds rate is 3.75 to 4%. It says once again that the worrying part from the Fed's point of view is jobs. Job gains have slowed and the unemployment rate has edged up, says the Fed. Inflation has also moved up and remains elevated. Now, what's interesting is we are heading into the scenario that really Jay Powell, the chair, doesn't want, which, of course, is higher inflation, stubborn unemployment, and he has to cut rates because he has to choose between unemployment and inflation, which is the most pressing problem. It's a very rare scenario that the Fed finds itself in. But now it's clearly made its choices. The core issue is that of unemployment. And so the Fed has cut rates to bolster the employment or the unemployment situation. Let me just read you the one bit. There we go. As I've just proving myself right, if you will. The committee is attentive to the the committee is attentive to the risks of both sides and judges the downside risks to employment rose in recent months. Voting against was Mr. Miron, Stephen Miron, who wanted to lower rates by half a percentage point, and Jeffrey Schmid, who preferred no change at all. What a fascinating Fed. We've got a majority for lowering. One wants to go faster. One wants to go slower.
So, Richard, you and I have spoken about this because of the US government shutdown, there are lots of readings we haven't had, right? And I've asked my producers to put a graphic up just so viewers get real sense. We haven't had jobs report, jobless claims, jobs report, PC prices. All of these have been delayed, of course, because of the government shutdown. So how do they make these policy decisions while in the dark, Richard?
Well, they have other numbers. They have a lot of private economy numbers, those from banks and economic forecasters. So they've got a vague idea. And also they knew the trajectory. There are other numbers from those parts of the economy that are still functioning. They can extrapolate. It is a poor best, by no means satisfactory. The quality of the data that you just showed is really essential, particularly the jobs, particularly when jobs is the number. But we do have private surveys that show the number of new jobs being created, the employment scenarios. They're just not as robust. They're not as big. They're not as, they don't have the same integrity. There is a clear, I wouldn't say they're flying blind, but they've certainly got an eye patch on and it's foggy weather outside.
Right. So when we listen to Jay Powell in less than 30 minutes or so, Richard, what are we looking for? Because last time you and I spoke, it was concerns over inflation. Now it seems concerns over employment, right?
Yeah. And that's been the concern for the last few couple of meetings. Yeah. What I'm listening for, number one, the very point you just said, how far off is he? How worried is he doesn't have the tightness of data he requires? Number two, is he done? Bearing in mind, look at that split. One wants more, one wants less. The majority. Are the Fed done for now while they wait for quality data that really shows what's happening? My guess is they are done. Maybe one more cut, but they're not on a tear to cut much more than this. They need to wait. They need to find out. They need to be more data dependent. And for that, to be data dependent, Issa, you need to have data.
Yeah. It would help, wouldn't it? At the moment, they're in the dark, like you said. Richard, good to see you live for us from Riyadh.
Meanwhile, Donald Trump has instructed the Pentagon to start testing nuclear weapons.
The president just posted this evening, a couple of moments ago, actually, on Truth Social, where he is talking up U.S. nuclear weapons in a new social media post. He said that because of other countries' nuclear testing, that he has, quote, instructed the Department of War to start testing our nuclear weapons on an equal basis. My source tonight is the former Deputy Director of National Intelligence, Beth Sanner. And Beth, I'm so glad that you're here because I want to just read this entire post from the president from a few moments ago, because I think there's a few things in it that aren't true. And I'm very curious for your thoughts on this, because he said at 9:04 p.m., as he's on the way in South Korea to go meet with Xi Jinping, that the United States has more nuclear weapons than any other country. He says this was accomplished, including a complete update and renovation of existing weapons during my first term in office. Because of the tremendous destructive power, I hated to do it, but had no choice. Russia is second and China is a distant third, but will be even within 5 years. Because of other countries' testing programs, I've instructed the Department of War to start testing our nuclear weapons on an equal basis. And he says that process will begin immediately. First off, Beth, is what the president says in this post true? And secondly, what do you make of this announcement?
Well, you know, who has more warheads, nuclear weapons, Russia or the United States? Technically, Russia has a little bit more, but it also depends on how you count and what is an active warhead. And, you know, it gets kind of complicated. And I think that basically, the United States and Russia are at parity. You know, if you can destroy the Earth, you know, many, many times over, it really, you know, we're talking about angels dancing on the head of a pin. And China being a distant third is true. But my big picture here on the nuclear testing is this is something that you know, real hawks like Ambassador Bolton really pushed for in the first administration, and the president didn't do that. And I personally believe that it is a bad idea to go forward with U.S. nuclear testing. And here's why. Sure that there are constraints on us. And, you know, there are people you can argue, you can have discussions about this. There are constraints by us not testing. But when the United States tests, you basically give carte blanche to everyone else. And the reason that we don't test is because we've tested more than pretty much everyone else. We did thousands, over 1,000 at least, tests during the Cold War. And we have computer simulations, and real experts say, like, we don't really need to do that. Do you know how many tests China has done? 50. We've done thousands, 50, or at least over 1,050. So when you say that we're going to test, you're now allowing China to test. And so when the president correctly says they're a distant third, what would allow them to catch up faster? Partly testing, because they haven't done as much. And so my view on this is, yes, we give up a little bit in terms of constraining ourselves when we have a test ban treaty and we uphold it. But when we break that, other countries who are our adversaries benefit more than we do.
Well, how does someone like Xi Jinping, who is on his way for his first face-to-face with Trump in 6 years, how does he read a message like that moments before they sit down together?
I know. It's a little bit of a crazy Ivan, taking a Tom Clancy phrase. I don't really know what that came from or why it would be now. I think it might be that someone told him that China was testing, or I don't know exactly, but that's not really the case. So I'm not really sure what this point is that other people are doing it, so we should be doing. I'm not really getting that. I might be missing something, though. Okay,
well, what about,
'cause it's a new thing, and I haven't.
The other thing, though, that I thought about was the North Korea aspect of all of this that has kind of been part of this meeting. I was listening to the president speaking with reporters last night on Air Force One, and he was saying, you know, they'd been making some overtures about having the two of them sit down together. We have not yet seen North Korea respond to that, I don't think, but they were firing missiles off of their west coast the other day. Do you think that has anything to do with this calculation, or how is that something that they go into this meeting with that in the background?
Yeah. That's interesting, Caitlin. Very smart of you. Look, we've been waiting for North Korea to do a nuclear test, you know, for about 2 years now, and they haven't done one. That would be necessary, we think, for them to miniaturize their warheads enough that they could really be sure that an ICBM, which they have, that could reach anywhere in the United States, that it would have a warhead that would explode as expected. And so we've been waiting for them to do that. So this could be about North Korea. Now, those missile tests are short range ballistic missiles, and you know, maybe it could be a North Korea angle. As far as I know, there isn't going to be a meeting with Kim. The president has floated that, and maybe he's frustrated that they haven't responded. I don't know. We'll probably find out a little bit more about what this is all about in the next day or so. But it's interesting, and I don't know. I mean, I think that what President Xi would think about this is he's very unpredictable, and I'm having trouble having a stable relationship with President Trump. And I think that is not a virtue at this point in our negotiations with them.
I want to ask you about one other thing, because it kind of came up, I'm just going to say randomly. Just before this meeting, the president basically said that he wanted to revive the idea of nuclear testing. Mm-hmm. He put this on Truth Social, and he said he ordered the military to, quote, start testing nuclear weapons on an equal basis, and he wants to that process to start immediately. And just for history here, folks, the U.S. has not detonated a nuclear bomb in more than 3 decades. And the president, of course, is saying that should change.
It had to do with others. They seem to all be nuclear testing. We have more nuclear weapons than anybody. We don't do testing. And we've halted it years, many years ago. But with others doing testing, I think it's appropriate that we do also.
Who is he saying is doing testing?
That's the great mystery. So China has not tested since the 90s. Russia has not tested since the 90s. He may be confusing this with the delivery vehicle tests, exotic weapons that Putin was showing off even earlier this week. But there was no nuclear detonation involved in that. The only country that has tested has been North Korea, and their last test was about 6 years ago. So I'm not quite sure where this rash of nuclear testing that he's discussing is coming from. Now, there has been pressure from many in the nuclear community to say that you can't go 3 decades without doing tests, and mm-hmm. that it's not.
And we should say one of the reasons why they stopped is because they were using mathematical models, and they were able to say, "Look, we think there's another way to do this."
And because we got nations around the world to sign but not ratify, unfortunately, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, which was supposed to stop testing around the world.
Mm-hmm. Is this a sign the U.S., which had never signed on to nuclear proliferation, is just further disinterested in being a leader on the idea of, like, de-escalating nuclear ambition?
Right, and the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty.
And with that, we have now come to the conclusion after this episode of On the Reading News Analysis. To stay tuned for the Voters Preparation Program, brought to you by Bishop Lucas Katenda from Indafaya Bijou, it is goodbye.